Perhaps one of the biggest challenges we face today, both as a from society, with our own unique value system, as well as a secular society, is the pervasive use of social media that has really infiltrated literally every aspect of how we conduct ourselves, how we communicate, how we think, how we interact. In a sense, social media has forever altered the entire social fabric of our society. As human beings, we do not interact with each other the way we used to. We don't process information the way we used to. Our perceptions of ourselves, our perceptions of others, they're constantly evolving based on the digital age and social media. Social media is defined as computer-mediated technologies that facilitate the creation of sharing of information. Texting is very much a part of social media. It doesn't have to be Facebook, doesn't have to be Instagram or Snapchat or any of the other ones. If we text, we are on social media. So all the research that we're going to be discussing impacts anyone who communicates via text, via email. In a sense, social media really, it's a highly interactive social platform where participants share information, they share their lives, they interact with others virtually instead of face-to-face. Social media has become such an integral part of people's lives that it's often their primary method of communicating and interacting with others. We think that we can avoid it. Sometimes we think we can simply not allow it into our lives. Perhaps we can. But we need to understand how pervasive it is and how much a basic part of our society it has become. It's not like the old Nisayon of television, where a person's primary interaction with it was really not to interact at all. People who watch television sat back and were just either entertained by it or informed by it. They interacted by not interacting. And simply by choosing not to participate, we really, as a society, as a culture, as Eden, we really did not suffer any significant consequences. Social media, on the other hand, it requires interaction. That's how it works. And by choosing not to interact, we will be left out. I've heard from many boys in the classroom that if they're not on the class chat, if they're not on the class WhatsApp, they feel like they're missing out on major parts of the social fabric of the classroom. They feel isolated within the fabric of the class. Because these social interactions are now, they're so easy and so pervasive, so the concept of FOMO, which stands for fear of missing out, it's become very concerning for boys. It used to be much more of a girl's issue. When I was growing up, I never heard of FOMO. The kids are all talking about it now, much more than in the past. Of course, it's a perception, it's not a reality, but if a boy feels like he's missing out, or if a girl feels like she's missing out, what happens is it generates a feeling of distance between themselves and their classmates, and it generates a desperation to be a part of it. I've heard from many boys that if only they had a cell phone, if only they were able to do texting, they would be a part of the class. The reality is that participating in the class chat does not in any way mean that they have any friends. It has not solved any of the social issues that often these boys seem to have. Just being part of that group text really does nothing, but they become so desperate to be a part of it. There is only so much resistance that parents, that machanchem, there's only so much of a battle we can wage before it becomes very counterproductive. A while back, I worked with a boy who was shy, withdrawn, and he was a very high quality boy. But he struggled socially. And one day he comes into my office, he says he opened up a Facebook account and he has this many friends and that many friends. And he was way too intelligent to be fooled into thinking that a single one of these friends were friends. But it made him feel better. It really did. He had a desperate need to be noticed, that somebody should recognize him, that somebody should pay attention to him, that somebody should acknowledge that he actually existed. And even though he knew it was fake, it still made him feel good, and it's a very powerful pull. In a sense, that's to a certain extent what the social media revolution is doing. It gives people the very false sense of being noticed, that they exist. As a society, we struggle mightily with the issues of finding meaning and finding real value in our lives, especially the secular society, and we search for it in any way that we can, even in ways that we know ultimately mean nothing. When we're desperate to exist, when we're so desperate to make our lives meaningful, So we do whatever we can to elicit feedback from other people that we are valuable, that we have meaning, that we exist. Why else would I find it remotely interesting to share the silly minutiae of my life with somebody else, often a virtual stranger? Why would I do that, except the only reason is that I'm desperate that somebody should notice that I exist. Of course, we cannot deny the fact that participating in social media is very convenient. There is no denying that texting can be a very efficient form of communication, scheduling, getting things done. It is very, very efficient. And the truth is, it's like anything else. Can we use these new age technologies in ways that benefit us without damaging ourselves, without damaging our self-esteem, without damaging our relationships, without damaging our brain development in the pediatric brain, both cognitive development, both emotional development? Do we need to take an all-or-nothing approach? Can we use these technologies in moderation? Can we use them wisely and with seichel? Or is there no such thing? And the truth is, it's like any tool that can be very, very dangerous. We need to weigh the risks. What are the social, emotional benefits of it? What are the social, emotional risks? What are the potential benefits versus the potential downsides? I would just like to make note of the fact that we're not going to be discussing any of this from a Yiddishkeit perspective today for multiple reasons. The catastrophic damage that social media presents to Yiddishkeit, the high-level risks, the online access that present to a person's Yiras Shamayim, often out-and-out Yisurim, it's not going to be on the table for today, not because it's not important. Adarabba, it is by far the most important. Any mechanech, many parents, many chashuvim in the room, they have much more experience than I do. They can literally describe dozens and maybe hundreds of karbanis that just litter the sides of the road on the path towards good intentions of social media. Exposure to social media, as well as numerous other exposures, which are facilitated by technology, they can and they do have devastating effects on our tzibur. They affect the person, they affect men, they affect women, they affect them for the long term, they affect them for the short term. The impact on Yiras Shamayim is profound and often is life-altering. Even if a person is not absolutely damaged by it, there is no question that the subtleties that it damages as far as sensitivities to Yiddishkeit, Hashkafas HaTorah, Edelkeit, just poshut becoming more like the Goyim, it affects our families, it affects us with repercussions that are poshut not measurable. We're not talking about that today. Not at all. First of all, it's not my place. There are Chashuvim and Gedolim who have long ago proclaimed what Das Torah has to say about this inyan. Those who have taken their words to heart have long ago distanced themselves from these dangers. Many have not taken their words to heart, and my repeating it would accomplish nothing. Besides, it's not my place. I was wondering, however, that possibly hearing what secular research has to say about social media, what exposure to various forms of technology, what damage it does to us, what risks it presents to our humanity, as we shall soon see, may indeed resonate more with us. And as Rabbeim, as Machanchem, when we're working with a Talmidim, if we know what their struggles are, if we know what their lives are like and how profoundly their lives are being impacted by their exposure to social media, we may just have a little bit of a different impression about it. I actually heard recently from a very well-known Manal that when it comes to warning or educating people, really, about the risks that social media presents, again, it includes texting, it includes even very basic forms of social media, it does not have to mean Snapchat or Facebook or any of that. He says when it comes to warning and educating people about the risks that social media presents from a Yiddishkeit perspective, it has been, for the most part, a failure. For the most part. Either because we think it doesn't apply to us, or perhaps we think that we're strong enough to withstand the assaults that it makes on our Yiddishkeit, or perhaps we think it's overblown, it's not so terrible, or I'll be miskaber, it's fine, whatever the reasons are. Here in America, in Eretz Yisrael, it seems that it's different. Here in America, even B'nai Torah are very involved in social media. There are perhaps small insular groups that have been successful at distancing themselves from it as chaburas, as certain yeshivas or small communities. They may be matzliach, but for the most part, American Jews, even Torah Dikayidin, even to be the chachamim, are very much involved and participating in the social media experience. And even those who do avoid it, what about their children? It's an intense and constant battle that we are losing very badly. We really are. It would seem. that presenting the risks that social media presents from a Yiddishkeit perspective, at best, has had very limited success, whatever the reasons may be. So even though the risks that are presented to Yiddishkeit are very, very real, it doesn't seem that we're making all that much headway. There is a possibility that secular research may resonate more with some people, and in some ways, there's always a possibility that a person would be willing to risk certain aspects of their lives, but they may not be willing to risk their inherent mahus as a human being, as a person. And particularly when we deal with unmotivated populations, such as teenagers and children. So even though the arguments about Yiddishkeit often fall on deaf ears, but if they know that it represents significant and profound risks to their ability to earn a living, to their ability to have a happy marriage, to their ability to be productive members of society, to be fathers, to be spouses, to be mothers, they may be a little bit more willing to be more receptive, and if we are honest with ourselves, we ourselves might also be willing to be a little bit more receptive. I think we need to start by recognizing really how pervasive social media is and how much a part of our lives it has become. It's really very much a part of our lives, and the reality is, as we said before, we're going to be left out if we do not participate. And more importantly, perhaps our children will also feel left out. They will. For many people, their primary method of communication is social media. They no longer pick up the phone to call. Many, many people, especially in the younger generation, they prefer to text rather than call. It's a huge convenience factor. It doesn't require hello, how are you, the social etiquette, asking how the other person is doing. It's much more efficient. We don't have to be friendly and get right to the point with a minimum of time wasting, and it can be very efficient. And it's true. It is more efficient. It's faster. It's easier. It also removes all human decency. It depersonalizes every single social interaction that we have. It allows us to say things and to do things we would never do in real life, almost as if there is no person at the other end. But at the end of the day, that is our reality, and for many people, texting has become a primary method of interaction and communication. It may be a terrible method of communication, especially if we're dealing with things that are nuanced and full of emotion, but we need to recognize that if we don't text, we will be limited in our communication abilities. That is the reality. I've observed entire WhatsApp conversations taking place, not live, but rather in short bursts, that somebody sends a little message to somebody else, and then the other person listens and sends a message back, and then back and forth, like 10, 15, 20 times, these little short bursts of voice messages. We won't have access to that, because that's how many people do communicate, and it's becoming more and more. Every society, every culture will have its own level of participation and its own level of acceptability as to what is considered normal. Every age bracket has its own unique methods and styles of communication. We need to recognize that social media features prominently in today's communication, despite the fact that it's different across culture, ages, genders. Studies have shown that over 91%, these studies are a couple years old, so they're not quite current. I would suspect that there are much more today. But over 91% of adults own a mobile phone, and over 80% own a smartphone. So while these statistics may not be applicable to the Teridika community, but just the fact that it's so prevalent, just the fact that it's so pervasive in the rest of society is an indication of how much a part of people's lives it has become and what we are up against. It has become the norm. It has become the standard. Studies have found the average person spends almost 8 hours a day, 7 hours and 38 minutes a day, interacting with a digital device. It is a colossal amount of time, and if a person's peers are involved in that method of communication, it means that that becomes his only way of interacting with them, is through a digital device. The average person sends and receives almost 4,000 texts a month, which is my personal surveys I found is much, much higher than that. It has become such an integral part of how we communicate. Our relationship with technology is always fluid. As technology advances, as it changes, it's always in a constant state of flux. It's a very fluid and changing landscape, and we really have no idea what the world is going to look like going forward. I wanted to take a few minutes to really to try to understand the psychology behind the drive to text and to have communications via WhatsApp or all of these digital methods of communication, rather than speaking to a person face-to-face, rather than having that human contact. What's the appeal? The communication takes longer to type something out, definitely takes longer than just saying it. What is the appeal of this depersonalized communication. So there is a convenience factor, scheduling and confirming, and those types of areas, it's very efficient. But people are having these full-blown communications that go for pages and pages and pages, rather than talking on the phone face-to-face, or rather than speaking face-to-face. It's become common that somebody will send me a text and will say, can I call you now? What do you mean, could you call me now? Just call me. If I want to talk to you, I'll talk to you. If not, not. Why do you have to ask my permission to call me? I used to be very puzzled by it. If you want, just call. Why text me, ask me if you can call? It seems that calling somebody without getting their prior permission has become rude. And there's a very important reason for it. You can't just call somebody. You have to get their permission. Can I call you now? It's not a hefgevelt. You just knock on somebody's door and then walk in the door. You have to get permission to come in. I think that what has happened is that technology has allowed us to communicate and to interact without actually being present in the conversation. When I have a direct communication with somebody, either on the phone or face-to-face, there's a certain element of risk that I need to manage in the conversation. And there's a very high level of skill that I need to bring to the table in many different areas. I may sound unintelligent, I may get emotional, I may not respond appropriately. All of these risks need to be managed in real time, on the spot, as we go. There's no such thing as getting a communication when it's live and say, hold on, I need 5 minutes to think about it. There's no such thing. So when we're corresponding or interacting with somebody face-to-face or live, we need to be on the ball instantaneously. It's risky, and it can be very, very stressful. And when we say something, we're saying it to a person. We're saying it to someone directly. They get a raw, uncensored stimulus in what we said, and we get the feedback about how they respond to that instantaneously. If they are offended, we know right away. We are constantly being evaluated. There are so many aspects of who we are that are being evaluated in real time and on many levels, and we get the feedback right away. So a live conversation has a much higher element of risk as opposed to a dead conversation that takes place via texting or WhatsApp or any of the other things. Where in those situations, I have time to formulate my response. In a texting conversation, I feel I get the other person's communication, and then I have the luxury of interpreting it on my own time schedule. Nobody's judging my gut response. I don't have to respond right away. I can formulate a response. I can make sure to get it right. I don't have to worry about how the other person will respond because I don't really see it. I don't really care. So it's no wonder that these methods of communication have generated the fact that when somebody is used to them, every other form of communication becomes highly intimidating because it requires so much more from me. It's much more stressful to talk on the phone. It requires more on-the-spot judgment, and the penalty for messing up is much higher. That's why they ask, can I call you now? Are you ready to expose yourself to that type of a thing? And seemingly in today's dar that people are developing the fact that it's just not okay to do that anymore because you're putting them on the hot seat and you need permission to do that. So on the surface, it really seems great. Why not communicate in a way that's less stressful? Why shouldn't we have the ability to slowly and carefully formulate a response that's going to make the most sense? And on some level, it's true. And in some situations, it certainly may be very beneficial to formulate a carefully crafted response, especially in highly emotionally charged types of situations. This used to be what the old letter writing was. If you have something to say that needs Yishul Hadas, you sit down, you write a letter. Overall, it's a very poor method of communication. It dehumanizes the conversation. It totally destroys natural interactions. I personally would rather drive hours to talk to somebody face-to-face rather than even talk to them on the phone. What's happened is that the humanity of our interactions, our nonverbal communications, the body language cues, these are all crucial parts of who we are, what we bring to the table. And when we sanitize our lives, we pay the price in many ways. It's not my opinion. There is extensive research, as we shall soon see, from all over the world that demonstrates that as human beings, we are paying a significant price for what is essentially social isolation. Yes, it has its benefits, but the damage from a humanistic perspective is profound, as we shall soon see. And as educators, when we're working with our Talmidim, we need to know what their world is like. We need to know that they don't think like us anymore. Their perspectives are very different than ours because they have been raised with an entirely different set of circumstances, an entirely different set of rules. When we interact with somebody face to face, it also is, it's a much different type of conversation because it requires our full attention. Even if we're on the phone with somebody, if we're distracted when we're communicating with somebody, they can tell it. You can tell right away when you're communicating with somebody live and they're distracted, they're busy doing something else. It's readily apparent. Our responses are not on target. We don't seem as engaged in the conversation. So because it's readily apparent, if we're not primarily focused on them, there's a high level of accountability for us to remain engaged, for us to remain focused on the conversation. If we don't, we're going to be called on it. Somebody's going to notice, and likely they're going to say something. There's nothing like accountability to motivate us to pay attention. So when we communicate with somebody in a way that they can't tell if we're focused, if they can't tell if we're distracted, there's no accountability. And often, if we're really honest with ourselves, we will admit that when we're communicating with somebody in a way that they can't really tell if we are firmly engaged in the conversation, we tend to do other things. We'll check out all kinds of other things that are going on. Meanwhile, we're not fully engaged in the conversation. So imagine that we have become a generation of people who rarely, if ever, focus on somebody else exclusively without any distractions. What does that do to our ability to concentrate? What does that do to our ability to empathize with somebody else, to truly feel for them, for their situation? Let's remember that what happens is we become used to certain styles of communication. And when we are used to communicating while we are distracted, we will continue to communicate that way even while we are with people. In a sense, it's become acceptable to talk to somebody and to be distracted, to not give them our full attention, to check our phones, to check messages while we're talking to somebody. I think all of us will admit that we have become much more rude over the last 10 years, where we will readily interrupt conversations when in the past we would have never done that. We've seen the destruction of many forms of social etiquette. In the past, we would have found it acceptable to sit at the supper table and peruse their mail, to sit at a business meeting and peruse their mail. We do all of that. We check our cell phones right when we're communicating with people. What used to be considered downright rude has become acceptable. And the truth is, the advent of this probably began somewhere in the range of call waiting. We could be on the phone with somebody, having a perfectly regular conversation, and then there'd be a click on the line, and we feel this incredible urge to go check out who some, before caller ID, some random person who's calling. These, the phone companies, to bundle it separately. You have to pay for both if you wanted both. So people would get caller ID, they're going to have call waiting. Without caller ID, there'd be a click, be on the phone. Hold on, I got to see who that is. How bizarre is that? It's just bizarre to discard the current person in favor of a random person, and yet we become so accustomed to it, it's become standard, it's become normal. In a sense, we've sacrificed our humanity on the altar of technology. We really have. What does that do to our relationships? Can our children, our Talmidim, can they ever truly feel that they are the most important people in our lives if we are constantly distracted when we interact with them? Why do we feel we have to respond to every buzz? It means that when we are present with a person, when we are present with a Talmud, if we are talking to a student, we are not fully present at all, even if we don't respond. If that phone is in our pocket and our brain is paying attention to when it's going to buzz, the studies show that we are not as focused. We're just not as focused, even if we don't respond. Not only has technology dehumanized many forms of interactions and communications, but it has damaged the interactions that we have. We are all affected by the acceptability that has become so pervasive in our society that it's okay to be distracted, to not be fully present. And besides the impacts that it has on our relationships, what impact has that had on ourselves on a personal level, in our concentration, in our ability to stay on task, in our learning? There's no end to the damage that we are doing to ourselves, that we have made it okay to be distracted. And this is from a totally secular perspective. From a humanistic perspective, we're not talking here about dvar masurim that come from unlimited and unsupervised access to technology. I wanted to bring up a few more points before we really get to the research, but there's one point in particular that I wanted to bring up as far as the online environment that is very unique to the online environment. In the past, there used to be a person was who they were. Obviously, we all try to present ourselves in the best light possible. We always try to put our best foot forward. And in different types of situations, we try to present ourselves in ways that we feel will be acceptable in that particular type of a situation. But for the most part, a person is limited in their presentation by their nature, by their personality, by their background, by their gender. Pretty much, we take ourselves wherever we go. We are who we are. In the online environment, there is no such limitation. It doesn't exist. A person can essentially, they can live their dream. They could be a man, they could be a woman, they could be a 90-year-old, they could be a 4-year-old, they could be whoever they want with no limitations. They can act as they wish, they could present themselves as they wish with absolutely no repercussions because nobody knows who they are. They could be somebody by day, they could be somebody totally different by night, they could be somebody in yeshiva, they could be somebody totally different in their online persona. They can speak as they wish and nobody will ever know. So besides for the inherent fraud that's rampant online, which means you can't believe anything that's out there, but it's also damaging from a humanistic, from a personal perspective. Who are we? Many people present themselves as happy, popular, outgoing, busy in their online persona, but in reality is they're miserable, they're depressed. As a matter of fact, the studies really show this, that the presentation that people have online is markedly different than the presentation that they have in real life. Which means that our own self-identities are at risk. There is a benefit to living your dream and being able to maybe get out of our shell, especially if somebody, let's say, with shyness or social issues. But at what price? If we don't have a self-identity, if we're risking our humanity for it, we're paying a very heavy price for that anonymity. So I wanted to focus really on three primary areas where secular research has found that social media has had a very strong negative impact. And this negative impact is applicable both to children, to our talmidim, and to adults, to ourselves. But the ramifications for children are really particularly concerning, especially when we put it into the context of brain development. A child's brain is continuously developing. It's actually considered pediatric to the low 20s. Kid thinks he's 18, he's good to go. He's pediatric till about 24 or so. Which is why you see on college campuses, they're always demonstrating pro this, anti this. They don't see the shades. They see black and white. It's a developmental stage. Same way they're not really ready for lumdus yet. They're not really ready to make any life decisions. A pediatric brain has an underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, which translates into an underdeveloped ability in what's executive function, which means the ability to make decisions, to plan ahead, to accurately assess risk and long-term repercussions, not to act impulsively. In a sense, it's higher level thinking and planning, and because an adolescent or anybody until their low 20s has an underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, so the amygdala, which is responsible for emotion, it ends up playing a large role in decision making, which means that kids make impulsive, erratic decisions based on emotion and not really safe. And as anybody knows kids, you don't need to know anything to know that this is true. And there have been studies that have found that there's differentiated brain activity between adults and adolescents in emotional problem solving, which means that they solve problems differently when there's an emotion. And when we tinker with brain development, and social media tinkers with brain development, we should not be at all surprised if those individuals do not develop that same emotion problem solving ability as we have. And by them, the damage may very well be permanent. If being engaged excessively in social media, which includes texting and all the basic forms, doesn't have to be WhatsApp or Facebook or any of that stuff, if it impacts emotional health and causes deficits in empathic ability, if it affects our emotional ability to connect with other people in adults, kal vachomer, it stands to reason that when these brain deficits occur in the pediatric brain, they're more profound and more permanent. And what will this do to them as parents, as spouses, as friends, and as our talmidim? This is very much a part of our mission, to know what their lives are like and to do our best, as we'll get to ease it as much as we can, even though to a large extent it's a losing battle. While the brain is under development till the low 20s, what it's exposed to, its experiences, they can and do have formative long-term implications. So in whatever ways technology is altering how the brain processes information, in the pediatric brain, it may very well be permanent. If we are training brains to have less ability to focus, if we are altering their ability to form healthy, adaptive relationships, whatever ways those brains are being impacted may very well be irreversible. And we all know as parents and as rabbeim and as moras, as teachers, we will go to the ends of the earth to help our children. People fly all over the world. I've had people fly from weekly, from out-of-town communities to come and see me for crazy reasons, whatever they are. But people will go out of their way. There'll be mamash and meiser nefesh for their talmidim. I once had a reshiva who drove a bachur who had been in his yeshiva 6 or 7 years prior. He drove him every Thursday night at 12 o'clock at night, waited for him for an hour, and then drove him back. Rebbeim, Rashi Yeshiva, they will do whatever they can for their Talmidim. And very likely, the most important thing we can give them is right in our own homes. The more we can influence their brain development in ways that are adaptive, both cognitively, both emotionally, the healthier and more productive these children will be as adults. And there is nothing more disheartening and sad than knowing that something we did or failed to do has had negative repercussions that are permanent for our children and for our Talmidim. Healthy brain development is dependent on being stimulated, which is called neuroplasticity, and in normal social interactions, the studies show that when they do the EEG, so they could see which areas of the brain fire. So both areas of the brain, right and left hemispheres of the brain, are stimulated when there's a social interaction. Studies have found that texting, same communication, except it's via text, only one side of the brain is stimulated, which means that you're not going to have a balanced development in the brain. And for many areas of brain development, there seems to be windows of opportunity for those developmental stages. And if a child misses that stage, it may be very, very difficult to ever recover from it. So there are three primary categories that research has found to really have a very negative impact based on social media. Performance, social, emotional, and relationships, and these are very broad categories, and all of them have very wide-ranging implications and applications. Performance could be at work, at home, in school. Relationships could be friends, parents, children, all with varying degrees of intensities and responsibilities, as we shall see. So let's go to performance first. Multiple studies from all over the world, these are secular studies, have found that social media use is correlated with negative academic performances such as lower GPA, which means that when kids have cell phones, when kids text, they simply don't do as well in school. That's a fact. These studies don't identify why. All they do is they tell us the what. It's up to us to speculate why, but they tell us when kids have social media, when they're involved in social media, they don't do as well. Fascinatingly, however, there are other sort of distractions that not only don't have negative repercussions, but they actually enhance. When a kid reads the newspaper, when he listens to music, all of those stimulations have been correlated with higher academic performances. So it seems that it's not the distraction of the social media that is what's the gyrim for having the lower grades and the poorer performance. Being interested in current events, having hobbies, listening to music, they increase academic success, most likely because they expand the brain's horizons. What's damaging is not being interested in outside activities. What's damaging is the methodology that's used. And the texting and digital methodology seems to have very negative repercussions. And the truth is, this really is nothing new. People have always had outside interests. There are many gedolim that they would say used to play chess on the side, obviously making sure it's not too extreme, obviously making sure it doesn't take up too much time, as long as they were not intensely focused on it. Having hobbies is a very, very healthy thing. It was actually probably helpful. The difference here is not in the fact that they're having outside interests or being busy with other things. It seems that the way in which social media works, the way it forces us to interact, the way it forces us to focus, is inherently unhealthy. Another study found, the first study was younger kids, that post-high school kids, based medrash age kids, who use cell phones for social media purposes, texting and communicating, also had lower grades, indicating that the negative effects of social media are not limited to younger people, they're limited to older people as well, even older students on the verge of becoming adults. I imagine if we were to ask ourselves, how is our performance when we have a cell phone in the pocket, how is our performance impacted? I know I would be embarrassed if I would actually think about it. I strongly suspect, and as a matter of fact, the way the study was conducted, it wasn't that the students were intensely focused on it. It means that they occasionally, during class, check their messages, which is something that most people do throughout the day. It means that to a certain extent, they're dividing their time, they're dividing their attention between the subject matter at hand and their social media responsibilities. And simply the fact that they're dividing their time and dividing their focus affected their grades in general, even at times when they weren't looking at the phones, even at times that they were not distracted. So it's not my place to give Musar at all, Chas v'Shalom, but Yiddishkeit and connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu absolutely requires us to be engaged. It requires us to focus on what we're doing. And even if we only check it on the side, it means we're not as focused as we could be. And if in a school setting, checking social media, checking a text, checking what's going on, seeing if we have any messages, if that results in lower grades, imagine what it's doing to our Yiddishkeit. It used to be somebody walked into a Beis Medrash and they were locked in. There was no such thing as being distracted unless there was some sort of an emergency. Person walked into a room, he was simply unavailable. Yes, there was distractions, we can schmooze and battle and all kinds of things. But today, even when we're learning, we're not fully present. We're not fully engaged, simply having a phone on us, having it buzz, even if we ignore it, it means that we are not fully present in the moment. It means that our performance of learning is being diminished. Kal v'chaymer what it does to our Talmidim when they see us. The London School of Economics, which is a juggernaut of an organization, ran a large-scale study that involved multiple schools, public schools. We're not talking yeshivas, we're talking public schools, regarding cell phone use in schools in Britain. And they discovered that when schools institute cell phone bans, when schools don't allow cell phones, general performance went up. These are secular schools. It was fascinating that in the study they found that the students who were weakest experienced the biggest performance when they banned the cell phones, meaning that the students who have the most to lose will lose the most when exposed to social media. And that by not allowing it in school, we are helping those who need our help the most. Of course, we all lose out. And who could say if a weaker student not succeeding is any less important or more important than a stronger student? But we all know that keeping our children on the Derech HaTorah and helping them to succeed in Yiddishkeit, academic success plays a very powerful role in that. There is nothing like success to help a person feel good about himself, and nothing like failure to help a person feel, to make a person feel unfulfilled. And the more tools we can give our children, the more tools we can give our Talmidim, the more we can remove those impediments to success, the more likely it will be that they will end up remaining productive members of Klal Yisrael. And although the studies examined social media usage in school settings, but the pashtus is that these findings will apply across the board in any type of academic situation. When we're trying to learn, when we're trying to focus, even at home, likely we'll experience the same results. Many of us, we're jealous of people who seem to be able to multitask. Based on our observation, people who multitask, they get tremendous amounts done, it has increased productivity. These are high energy people, always on the go, always busy with a million things. These people seem to get a lot done. Everybody wants to be able to multitask better. Who doesn't want to be able to accomplish more than we do now? Current research of multitasking, however, paints quite a different reality. The studies have found that multitasking, instead of being more efficient, is actually a highly inefficient way of accomplishing anything. When a person multitasks, it actually results in more difficulty focusing, more difficulty in sorting out relevant information, and it ends up generating much higher stress levels. Essentially, what the studies show is that when a person multitasks, instead of focusing well on multiple items, he ends up focusing poorly on all of them. And because the lack of focus while accomplishing a task, when he's multitasking, so what happens is his ability to sort out information, when we're doing one thing at a time, the brain is constantly flooded with all kinds of different bits of information, and we sort them. We give them a hierarchy based on what's needed. The brain is constantly filtering and sorting information, and when somebody loses that ability to focus, so their ability to sort out that information becomes impaired. We're always sorting. We sort information based on importance. We sort it based on relevancy. We sort it based on danger. We sort it based on financial reasons, relationship factors. And when a person is multitasking and he loses his ability to accurately and efficiently sort information, it ends up that the overload of information becomes so much more overloaded and so much less efficient and less accurate. And essentially what happens is multitasking really is task switching, where he switches from one task to the other in a very inefficient way, and it results in poorer focus and less efficiency in information processing. Task switching also results in a significant reduction in the study shown in working memory. Working memory is his ability to absorb information and hold it and manipulate it for the short term. And it makes a lot of sense because all the studies show that working memory is directly related to focus. So if we don't focus well, we're not going to remember well. So what happens is when people try to do many things at once, instead of accomplishing a lot, they're actually doing all of them very poorly and very inefficiently. And studies have found, and this is really where we're getting to, that patterns of fractured thinking tend to persist even when the person is no longer multitasking, which would indicate that the brain becomes used to certain patterns of thought. And when those patterns of thought become part of how he operates, he takes them with him, or she takes them with her, wherever she goes. When we are engaged in social media, we are essentially doing task switching. That's the nature of how it works. It's constantly engaging our attention for a short-lived interaction, a short-lived stimulus, and then moving on to something else. So what's happening is we are training our brains to process information in a task-switching pattern, and the brain retains those patterns of lack of focus and less efficient information processing. A recent study found that the average computer user changes the simulated environment 37 times an hour, visits 40 websites daily. I actually think it's much higher than that. We are severely impairing our ability to focus, to stay on task, and to maintain that focus, and this is for adults. What happens to the pediatric brain? So I haven't seen studies on this directly, but there are very frightening studies that have identified that incidence of ADHD have risen over 66% over the last 10 years. And ADHD is essentially a problem of attention, and it's a problem of persistence and the ability to stay on task, indicating that over the last 10 years there has been an astronomical increase in attention problems, essentially confirming exactly what we're saying, that the increased exposure to task switching has negative implications or negative consequences in our ability to stay on task for the long term. And if we think back, what happened 10 years ago, that's when the iPhone was introduced. So over the last 10 years, exactly in sync with social media and the tremendous proliferation of task switching, our children are being damaged by their ability to stay, in their ability to stay on task and ability to stay focused. As an aside, there's an interesting phenomenon called the Google effect, I like to call it the art scroll effect, that describes deficiencies in memory when information is readily accessible. When I can look up something instantaneously, when I don't have to retain it, because I can always look it up again, I don't remember it. Because I'm not desperate to remember it, I can always look it up again. And because the spread of information is so readily accessible, we are damaging our ability to remember things. From a social emotional perspective, there have been numerous studies that have examined the effects of social media exposure on a wide range of social emotional health issues. And again, the purpose here is that when we recognize what our Talmidim are being exposed to, it gives us an entirely different perception of what their lives are like. For example, one study found that people who are engaged in social media, which includes texting, they have higher levels of anxiety and lower levels of life satisfaction. Meaning that they're just unhappy. They're much less happy than they used to be. In general, it's important to keep in mind that grades and school performance are also correlated with life satisfaction. So if social media is impacting grades and it's directly impacting life satisfaction, which means it's a double whammy. It's impacting life satisfaction directly, and it's also impacting grades, which also impact life satisfaction, and it makes a lot of sense because when somebody's not producing well, when somebody's not performing well, especially if their goal in life at that period of time is to perform academically, they're not going to be happy. They're engaged in a task all day that they're just simply underperforming, and they're not going to be happy. Wait till the end. Ask me at the end, unless it's relevant. We'll get to that. I think there is a mahalach. I mean, not that I'm a great chacham, but I think there is somewhat of a mahalach. Other studies have found that cell phone use tends to be correlated with lower levels of happiness. The studies go on and on. They're international studies from Sweden, from Finland. We could spend time going through all the studies. If somebody would interact in an intermittent manner with it, so it wouldn't be altering brain development. What happens is, in other words, it would be a tool that we use. Because we have it, because it's so readily available, that becomes how we interact. That becomes how our brains start to process information. It's the excessive use of it. As far as Var Masurim, that's a one-time thing. As far as this, it's the persistent low-level abuse that our brains are constantly damaged with over long periods of time that are just, they're destroying our humanity. Well, we'll get to that momentarily even more. I don't want to go through all the studies, I just think we're going to run out of time. There was a fascinating study, to me this is mom's fascinating, it was a study in a journal of psychiatry that looked at rat development. We're not talking human development, we're talking about rats. And they found that when the parental rats were distracted during a parenting task, they were very specific in the article, making the bedding for the rats or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was. When the parental rats were distracted during their parenting duties, it affected their offspring's ability to develop healthy social and emotional skills, particularly in areas of pleasure, which we all see in our kids today. They are desperate for the next rush. They're desperate with the road trips. We don't have to get involved in what's going on in the teenage world today. But their ability to be satisfied with basic pleasures of life are very, very diminished. Of course, we need to be cautious because we're talking here about rats. We're not talking about human beings. But it should certainly be enough to make us sit up and take notice. And in my personal opinion, all our alarm bells should be blaring. If it impacts a rat's emotional development, what on earth is it doing to us? If distracted parenting stunts rats' emotional development, we should be panicked at what it's doing to human emotional development. And when parents are distracted, even if they're good parents, even if they're involved parents, if they're distracted when they're parenting, if rabbeim are distracted when they're dealing with their class, it affects the development. And certain skills, it seems that there are windows of opportunities to develop certain skills, and opportunities may be lost forever. And the truth is that in this dar of constantly being distracted, I think we're all guilty of it. We all have seen like the extreme examples of people walking into poles and walking into fountains. We've all seen the silly stuff. But it happens on a micro level, day in and day out, and that's really where the damage happens. Social media use has been found to lower levels of self-esteem very significantly. It results in being less accepted by peers when we have less face-to-face communications. Children have more friendships that their parents are unhappy with when their kids are involved in social media, including texting. These are basic life skills. This has nothing to do with anything other than a basic life skill. And it seems that face-to-face communication is very important for developing a healthy self-image. We need that human contact. Think to ourselves, if we need somebody to talk to, are we going to text them or are we going to talk to them? No, there are people who have these intense texting dialogues with each other that I've seen. I think there's reasons why they do it, because they can't bear to do it face-to-face. But if somebody needs a human contact, somebody needs a shoulder to cry on, somebody needs something from somebody, they're going to do it face-to-face. And there's a reason for it, because that is our humanity. A Finnish study found links between cell phone use and alcohol and smoking. A Swedish study, we can go on and on with the studies. What happens is that because we're always carrying devices that put us on, we're always on, the body is always on high states of alert for that buzz, for whatever it is that's coming. It used to be that a person had times of downtime. He went to work, he went to yeshiva, he came home, he went to learn. Every different environment was different than the one before. So even though each of those environments may have required his attention, and they may have been stressful, but it was a break from the previous environment. Today, we're in the same environment all day long, and all night long. People keep their cell phones by their beds, they're always texting. What happens is the body has what's called an allostatic load, which is the baseline level of arousal that it has. And when we are carrying these devices, the body's load is always elevated. It's always elevated. We are always on a high state of alert, and we never turn off. We go to a chasana, we walk around, everybody's always on the cell phone. So as Yidden, we have a distinct advantage. We shut it off 24 hours every week, which is a tremendous thing. It's an absolutely tremendous thing. They used to say it about smoking also, that a Yid doesn't, the same studies don't apply. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But it's an absolute tremendous advantage that we're shut off for that one period of time. But the truth is that it likely doesn't make much of a difference, because the patterns that the brain has learned are still there, even on Shabbos. It's not about the texting. It's about training our brains. We're doing a really good job of training ourselves to be distracted, not to be focused, to be whatever damage it's doing, the brain continues those patterns of thoughts and those patterns of behavior, even through Shabbos. I've just talked to somebody in the financial world who told me that this past, I think it was Matzi Yontif, he looked at his phone, somebody texted him at the Zman. Like, he didn't even make Havdalah yet. Which means that this person was, this was on their mind, the whole Shabbos, the whole Yontif. We're always on, we always have that allostatic load. We never really disengage. Emotionally, we're always connected. And perhaps the price that we pay is highest where it counts the most, which is our humanity. And I really suspect that the biggest damage that social media is doing that's really a direct result, studies have found that there has been a sharp decline in empathy over the past 10 years, all over the world. Empathy really is our ability to enter another person's world, to feel their pain, to recognize somebody else as a human being, to identify with their feelings, their emotions. If we are losing our ability to empathize with other people, we are losing the very essence of our humanity. If we're having fewer face-to-face communications, so what happens? It means we are experiencing fewer verbal cues. We no longer experience somebody else's joy in response to something we said. We no longer experience their sadness. We're not exposed to their hurt. We're not exposed to their appreciation. In general, we are far more desensitized to shocking and violent images. Even the frum websites have these horrific videos that are perfectly kosher, but they're horrible, horrible videos, and the studies have been going on for decades that show when a person is exposed to that, it desensitizes them, it impacts the neshama, it affects who they are as human beings. Studies have found that there are much higher levels of self-reported narcissism over the past 10 years. We're becoming more selfish, we're becoming more self-centered. Our ability to be empathic and caring for others has become diminished. When we don't experience other people as people, when we're not exposed to their emotional responses, when we don't feel, when we don't see their pain, we tend to care less about them and more about ourselves. It's very easy to say something in a text, in an email, that we would never say face-to-face to a person. If we say something directly to a person, so what happens is we are burdened by their response. If we say something hurtful, they have a response, and we're burdened by that. We need to carry that with us. It's not a good feeling. To know that you hurt somebody, it's just not a good feeling. We need to take responsibility for what we did to them. That's a very powerful deterrent. Not to say something hurtful. Not to say something insulting. Because I am going to pay the price. In a text or an email, there is no such burden. There is no such responsibility. I say what I want. I send it out there. And I go about my merry way. With no repercussions at all. I don't have to take any responsibility for my behavior, which is probably why the levels of empathy and the levels of narcissism have really just been destroyed over the past many years. We don't get to see the facial expressions. We don't get to see the hurt. And as human beings, what this has done to us is incalculable. As far as relationships, so studies have found that the researchers tend to call technoference, where relationships impact, the technology impacts relationships, what they call technoference. Studies have found that when involved in social media, there's higher conflicts in relationships, lower relationship satisfaction, lower life satisfaction. As we have found already, it decreases levels of happiness, higher levels of depression. It's ironic that the social media world has made us all connected. Everybody's much more connected. But it's an illusion, because the more we have the illusion of being connected, it really results in increased isolation. We're becoming lonelier, we're becoming more depressed. The more connected we are to social media, the lonelier we are. We need to sit in a person's presence. We need to look them in the eye. We need that genuine human contact. We need that social interaction with people. Many, many studies have found that technology significantly interferes with quality time together. It can be intrusive. And if we think about it, when we are with our talmidim, when we're with our children, when we're with a spouse, and we respond to a buzz, what message does that send? It sends a very powerful message. What is important? And perhaps, more importantly, what is not so important? If we're talking to a talmid, we're talking to a student and we look at a phone, even if we just look at it, we've sent them a message that I'm looking at something else that's not as important as you, even if we then put it down. When our children observe this, how we interact with our spouses, they form those opinions also. What is the most important person in my life? Obviously not your spouse, because otherwise you wouldn't pay attention to some random buzz that comes on. When we do it to them, what message are we imparting to them? So what can we do? This is really tachlis. So on the one hand, we want to give our kids, our talmidim, every opportunity for success. And seemingly limiting social media will have a profound impact. It will give them every single advantage possible in performance, social, emotional relationships. We just do better overall when we are not engaged in social media. But we also need to recognize that we live in a reality and it's a dominant form of communication. It's very, very, very difficult to say we just won't participate. Sometimes, for some ages, maybe certain cultures, certain communities, it's possible. For the vast majority, it's simply not practical. It's not like the old days of television, as we said. This is very much a part of our lives. Research has demonstrated that perhaps the most powerful method of influencing behavior is through modeling, and in particular parental modeling, or when Rabbeim model it. When we model communication styles, when we model appropriate interactions, the observations of those activities are very powerful. I'm not getting involved in whether we should have a smartphone, not have a smartphone, any phone. What I'm talking about is how we use it. When our Talmidim and Talmidais, when they see how we use it, when we see how what our relationship is like with it, when they see that we don't allow ourselves to be distracted by it, when they see that when we are with them, they are the most important person in the entire world, and when we're talking to another Rebbe or another teacher, and we do not allow ourselves to be distracted, if we can model appropriate social media interactions, it can have a profound impact on our kids, on our development, on their mental health, on their relationships, on their, well, ultimately, on really the very essence of their success, on their happiness. If we can participate without the constant tether, without always being connected, of being present for our Talmidim, of being present for our kids, if we don't text during meals, if we just are highly conscious and highly cognizant of the fact that these little micro interruptions are so catastrophically damaging. Not one at a time, not each one. Each one alone is nothing, which is why it's very easy to do. But the micro additions of tens of thousands of these things over time, they are having catastrophic impacts on the essence of our humanity. They really are. We need to engage in healthy activities together when we learn with our kids, when we learn with our Talmidim. So besides the fact that if we're distracted with a phone, so then it sends a very powerful, horrible message that learning is not the most important thing, and I don't have to be fully engaged, but it also sends a message to them that I'm distracted when I'm learning with you. And we need to be aware that we will not be successful in this campaign, which I really believe is crucial to our kids' development, pashut as human beings, putting Yiddishkeit aside, we will not be successful unless we model it, unless we are willing to do what we want from our children, if we are willing to limit our access. Of course, we also need to model appropriate interactions as far as the fact that a person can trust himself. We need to model the fact that we need levels of accountability. If a father is not willing to put on a filter, then what does that tell his kid? The web chaver programs, the accountability programs, making sure computers are in public access, making sure things are password protected. Lack of opportunity is a tremendous deterrent. And the best way to teach the fact that we should never trust ourselves is to model it for ourselves. If we limit the amount of time we spend in useless types of things, we'll be modeling it. Modeling it is really the best way to teach anything. And of course, there are multiple ways to frame a message and to try to influence behavior. We can present concepts from a negative, punitive approach that this is no good, or we can present really those same concepts from a positive, from a growing approach. And we try to modify behavior with that negative sort of approach. What happens is it becomes an us against them attitude, and whoever is more powerful wins, and ultimately the adults start out more powerful, but the kids always end up more powerful than the adults. When we try to modify behavior with a positive approach and that everybody's on the same team, when we're trying to be Meroimin people, so what happens is everybody joins the same team and everybody becomes a winner. If we can really frame that message of social media, that yes, it's a tremendous pull, yes, the conveniences are really innumerable. They are very convenient. It is very convenient. Yes, it gives us tremendous access, but yes, it also damages us as human beings. And the more we can limit it, the more we can keep it within proper gedarim, we can elevate ourselves, we can elevate our families to be really healthy and productive people. I wanted to just add one more nekuda when it comes to modifying behavior, and with that we'll end, that research has demonstrated that one of the most powerful influences on modifying behavior has to do with peers. And both negatively and positively, we and our kids care greatly what their friends think, much more than what their parents think, much more than what their rabbeim think. So if their friends are involved in social media, this is what their friends are doing, including texting, we are going to be very, very limited in what we can do. Ultimately, it's really going to be a losing battle. But when we can involve the peers, especially the studies show that high-status peers, all of this really is pushed, but that when the popular kids are doing something, everybody wants to join them. Everybody wants to follow. And if we can target those high-status peers, we'll be in very good shape with this. And the studies are even more powerful than that because they show that when the high-status peers, the popular kids, have a certain mahalach, then the other kids want to emulate that even when they're not around them, which means even when a kid is in his room, the influence of those peers are very much in effect, which is an incredibly powerful thing. So if we can create that common goal, yes, each parent has a responsibility for his own child and to try to model it, but the bottom line is really we need to do more than that. We need to work from a group perspective. We need to have a class where there is a common goal, not among the kids, where there's a common message from the parents that we are going to work, again, not from a Yiddishkeit perspective even, which of course it should be and it could be, but if we are going to focus as parents on limiting our social media contact, if we're going to recognize that the damage that it's doing to us, on Kal V'chaimer, Ben B'noi Shal Kal V'chaimer, what it's doing to our children, to their brain development, to a 10-year-old, to a 12-year-old, to an 18-year-old, if we can have a group of like-minded parents who are willing to inconvenience ourselves, and I speak to myself more than anybody else, of like-minded parents who are willing to really inconvenience ourselves and try to form classes in the yeshiva that we are parents who this is how we want. Nothing to do with Var Masurim. Pashut, we want to give our kids every advantage. We want to give them every advantage in being good husbands, in being good fathers, in being good wives, in being just, it's Pashut, a developmental process that is very much impacted by social media. And when we can recognize that and put that into how we conduct ourselves and model it for them, and helping our children recognize that there is a significant price to pay for it, the social environment is going to be the key. And creating that social environment that has a pride in its mission, that has a recognition that what we're trying to accomplish is something that's from a humanistic perspective. It will go a very long way towards helping our kids resist the pull. We need to be proud of who we are, and we need to be proud of what we stand for. And may HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us the strength, the foresight, to survive, to grow in really what may be the most dangerous times Yidden have ever lived in.
This speech is provided by Smart Choices. For the Smart Choices hotline or to order CDs, call 732-400-9003.